Okay, let's get started. Ruth Berggren, MD, MACP, directs the Center for Medical Humanities and Ethics at UT Health San Antonio. In this role, she teaches ethics and professionalism while nurturing empathy and humanitarian values. The center focuses on four areas: ethics and professionalism, global health, community service learning, and medical humanities. Dr. Berggren arrived at the UT Health San Antonio in fall of 2006 after an eventful stint at New Orleans Charity Hospital, where she stood by patients in the HIV ward during Hurricane Katrina until all were safely evacuated. She was named the director for the Center of Medical Humanities and Ethics here in San Antonio in October of 2007. The daughter of public health physicians, Dr. Berggren spent her childhood in Haiti. She earned a Bachelor of Arts in Biology with high honors from Oberlin College, followed by an MD from Harvard Medical School. She completed an internal medicine residency at Massachusetts General Hospital and an infectious diseases fellowship at the University of Colorado. Board certified in internal medicine and infectious diseases, Dr. Berggren has extensive experience in clinical AIDS and viral hepatitis care and research, as well as HIV care in resource-poor settings. Most recently, she has been active in responding to the COVID-19 pandemic as a member of the San Antonio's health transition team and a special advisor to Bexar County. Dr. Berggren is the Marvin Forleo MD Distinguished Professor in Medical Ethics, and she holds the James J. Young Chair for Excellence in Medical Education. I knew Jim. He's a great guy. He was a great guy. On an aside, Dr. Berggren was featured on the front cover of San Antonio Woman's January-February 2010 magazine. I looked up the article and reread it. Again, it really touched my heart. And what I'm going to do in my follow-up email tomorrow, I'll be sure to include the link for this article because I know after you hear her, you're going to want to read that wonderful, wonderful article. So, Ruth Berggren, it is all yours. I'm going to mute and shut my mouth.
Well, thank you for that incredibly generous introduction. I think we sent you a shorter version, so I apologize if that was long. Are you able to hear me?
That was the shorter one.
That was a shorter one. Okay, well, we'll work on shortening it. But I'm delighted to be with you, and it sounds like you have a wonderful group here today. If I seem to be speaking with some pressure, please forgive me. I just verified these numbers. Yesterday we had 2,918 people die of COVID. And at 3,000 deaths a day, that's two per minute, which means that by the time we end our talk, this gathering that we have together on Zoom right now, there will be 60 more deaths. So, as someone who teaches about medical ethics and professionalism, as someone who is actively engaged clinically, I have been attending on the COVID service. I can tell you that this is very close to home and it's of great concern. So we're going to talk about how do we get here? And I'm going to fly through some of those slides because what I really want to do is get to where are we going and what can we do? And also, full disclosure, I had my COVID vaccine yesterday. So not all doom and gloom. I'm about hope and progress. And I want to make sure that I get to tell you about what I have to share about the vaccine. All right. And oh, let me go back and just say and some of my slides were contributed by colleagues. So Doctors Jan Patterson, Phil Ponce, and Barbara Taylor, they're all infectious disease docs that I work with at the UT Health Science Center. And Jennifer Saracero is a staff member. And most of them, when I've borrowed a slide, I've indicated, but I'm very grateful to them and we're a real collaborative team. All right, so coronaviruses, as you probably know by now, have been around for a long time. We seem to see an emergence of a problem coronavirus about every decade. But looking back, SARS was a big deal to me as an infectious disease doctor in 2002, but we had fewer than 800 deaths that we know about. The MERS, Middle Eastern Respiratory Virus, came out in 2012, still 848 deaths. So The COVID-19 pandemic is drastically different, and those that count of deaths is from an older slide, and I'll update you in just a moment. That what they do have in common is that they all seem to have had an intermediary host from the animal world. And up on the right-hand side of my slide, we're looking at a cartoon of the virus itself to try to give you an idea of its dimensions, its diameter of 100 nanometers. And that is going to become relevant when we talk about N95 masks and how those masks actually work to protect us. There's some more detail on here that probably isn't all that exciting for you all, but I do want to say that the size of this virus's genome is larger than that of influenza, and we think that's important in providing it with some stability, because we care about what our enemy looks like and whether it's going to mutate rapidly or more slowly, because that will, of course, affect our strategies for immunity and prevention. Now, four other coronaviruses that cause the common cold have been known and been around since the 1960s. In fact, we do regularly test people with swabs up the nose to do something called a respiratory virus panel. And we've had four different coronaviruses in there forever. But they're different enough that, of course, they can cause very different spectrum of diseases. I love this electron micrograph because I love the color turquoise, but this is actually virus and human cells. And the photograph was taken at our own NIH. It's a scanning electron microscope image with SARS-CoV-2, the name of the virus that causes COVID-19, shown as these round blue objects coming out of the surface of cultured cells. Now, the point that I also want to make, besides how beautiful this electron micrograph is just get a sense of just the scope and the scale of how many virions must be in someone's body if you're looking at this many budding out, you know, from a single cell. There's just an enormous, enormous amount of viral replication, which of course translates into both the inflammatory response that we see and infectivity of other people. This is, we'll not dwell too long on this slide, but it's looking at the nucleotide relatedness of SARS-CoV-2 to the other coronaviruses that I've mentioned. And it looks like that the currently circulating SARS-CoV-2 is most highly related to the bat coronavirus. We thought at one point that the intermediary of this scaly, funny-looking anteater creature called the pangolin might have been important. It turns out that it's SARS-CoV-2 is more highly related to what's in bats even than what's in the pangolin. And you can see when you compare the nucleotide identity to the common cold, it's only about 50% similar. And the length of it here, 30 kilobases, is again, something we infectious disease nerds care about when we're comparing it to other viruses that mutate like influenza. So how long does it take a single person to yield a million infections? It's worth going through this exercise a little bit and to define the basic reproduction number, or R0. It's designated R0, but we call it R0. We think that R0 typically with SARS-CoV-2 is around 2. Could be 2 to 4, and it absolutely depends on the context, as you all know, because at super spreader events, we sometimes have one individual infecting many more than just two other people. So it's a moving target, what R0 is. We know that the median latent time is about 3 days, meaning if I went to lunch with Linda, it would be about 3 days before somebody would be able to detect SARS-CoV-2 in mine areas. So don't have lunch with Linda and run out and get tested immediately afterwards. And that's followed by about 4 days of the maximal infectiousness. And if you, just as a thought exercise, if you assigned a value of 4 to R0, meaning one person was going to infect 4 others, then in that scenario, the number of cases would quadruple every 7 days or double every 3 days, and you'd expect 1,000-fold growth in a month, 1,000,000-fold in 2 months, and 1,000,000,000-fold in 3 months. Well, we haven't quite gotten to a billion, so clearly R naught must be less than four, and some of our measures are working. Here's the updated slide from today, the Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Resource Center. I'm sure you're all familiar with it. We're up to almost 74 million cases globally, with 16.7 million in the United States leading the world. We've had 1.6 million global deaths and over 303,000 in the United States. And this map, which just started out as a few red dots scattered over the globe in January and February, is now turning into just a sea of red, which is perhaps an appropriate color because the deaths are accumulating and it's been just extraordinary. So the effect of social distancing, the physical distancing, people complain about it a lot, but given the math that we just went through, I'm gonna do a little more math with you. Suppose you're infected and you encounter 50 people over a day. Not unusual in a normal day for me at the Health Science Center with the teaching that I do and the various committees that I am on and social events or fundraisers that I might go to. But let's further suppose that a person who normally sees 50 people in a day has a 2% chance of transmitting the virus in each encounter. That would make you likely to infect one new person each day. If you're infectious for 4 days, we're still going with that R naught of four as a hypothetical, then you would infect four others on average, which is on the high end of the R naught values that have been reported here and there for SARS-CoV-2. Now, if you cut it down from 50 to five, because of physical distancing or working from home, now you're going to infect 0.4 people before you become less infectious. So it's just math, but it seems to make people kind of mad, and somehow we've layered a lot of politicization over this. Why was the initial quarantine period 2 weeks? And heads up, I'm gonna tell you the CDC's update on that, because there's some nuance now to the quarantine period. There's an awful lot of variation from person to person, and the period of time from that infection to symptoms is called the incubation period. Median incubation period for SARS-CoV-2 is roughly 5 days, but 99% of people who get infected are gonna show their symptoms before day 14. So if you really wanna get them all, you go out to 14 days. And about 97.5% of individuals who develop symptoms are gonna do so within 11 and a half days of infection. So if you have an exposure, and over the last several months have been several times where I thought I might've been seriously exposed to a patient, I hold my breath for about 11, 12 days. And if I haven't gotten symptoms by then, I start to feel a little bit better. Healthcare workers, depending on where you're at in a surge, don't necessarily quarantine after having been exposed to an infectious patient, because we have PPE and we're also essential healthcare workers. And if we're asymptomatic, sometimes we actually just have to keep going to work, even if we've had an exposure. We also continue to not fully understand asymptomatic spread. The variation in estimates of how much transmission is happening in people who have no symptoms, people who we call pre-symptomatic, is wide. So 48 to 62% of transmission may occur in pre-symptomatic carriers. Now, I told you, heads up, there's new CDC quarantine guidelines. Why did they do this? Basically, they were feeling like nobody was quarantining at all because it was so onerous. And they thought that maybe they could get a little harm reduction if without completely eliminating risk by giving people a more easy to deal with real world guideline. So the new quarantine guidelines that you can look up yourself tell us that your quarantine can end after day 10 without testing if no symptoms have been reported. But you still have a risk of transmission with this, right? There's a trade-off. So your post-quarantine transmission risk is about 1%. If you do this 10-day thing and with an upper limit of 10%. So not trivial. Now, if you can add a test to that, the quarantine can actually end after 7 days if the diagnostic test is negative and no symptoms have been reported during the monitoring. It's important to note, though, you cannot discontinue the quarantine earlier than day 7 if you're using the test plus the number of days. And the residual risk here is a little bit higher. Okay, it's about 5% with an upper limit of about 12%. So you have an easier to deal with set of quarantine guidelines, but with the trade-off that you're gonna have some transmissions from asymptomatic people. I emphasized the size of the virion before of 100 nanometers. 0.1 micron is the size of particle for which N95 are capable of filtering almost 100% of the particles. There's a lot of fakes out there, and there's a lot of new masks being developed, and some of them are great and some of them are a bad idea. And if you have questions about that, we can talk about bad masks at the end of my talk. We still know that it's true that the viruses are most often transmitted through the respiratory droplets when we cough, sneeze, shout, or sing. However, we're starting to learn more about the fact that some of these droplets are smaller, they hang in the air, they desiccate, and they can float around and cause transmission in a room, although that is not as important as two people being within 6 feet of each other unmasked in terms of a mechanism. So lots and lots and lots of comparisons all the time to the flu. And sometimes this is being, these data are quoted sort of casually and incorrectly to serve someone's purpose. People often like to say, well, this is no bigger than the flu. So why are you bothering us? Why do we have to kill the global economy and turn things upside down? Flu is an entirely different family of RNA viruses. So these are RNA viruses, both corona and influenza. Influenza is small. Influenza infects human cells in a very different manner, doesn't use the ACE receptor like coronavirus does. And coronaviruses have the largest genomes, about twice as big, okay? 30 kb versus 14 kb compared to influenza. And this is exciting because we think it means that there must be a proofreading mechanism that reduces the mutation rate and stabilizes the genome. We want a low mutation rate because that would result in less variability and less need to have boosters to deal with changing needs for immune responses. What about mortality comparing COVID to flu? These are old data, but the issue is not whether they're old, it's whether they're comparing apples to apples. So we want to look at a 6 month period, mortality due to SARS-CoV-2 compared to a 6 month period of mortality in the world and in the United States due to influenza. So in the first 6 months, we had 650,000 deaths due to SARS-CoV-2, and globally, it would take us a year to have that many. As of July 28th, we had about 150,000 deaths. And in a similar period of 6 months, October to April of last year, we saw somewhere between 24 and 62,000 US deaths. So take away from this a couple of things. More people are dying from SARS-CoV-2 than influenza. I think you know that. Also take away, influenza can kill people and we should do better with our influenza vaccines. In any event, the situation continues to change rapidly. This is a new virus. We don't have immunity to it. A vaccine is here because I got one yesterday and I've got my immunization card to prove it. Here it is. This is what your immunization card from the CDC is going to look like when you get your vaccine. But we're continuing to learn. And so anything that I say here that seems different than what you've heard somewhere else, please understand that we're learning, and I'm happy to discuss with you if you've heard something different than my updated talk right here. What about infectiousness on a surface? I don't want to dwell too much on this. You've heard a lot about it. All different surfaces can have the virus linger on it, but we've learned now that even just because you find SARS-CoV-2 RNA on a tabletop doesn't mean that that's infectious virus, because the infectiousness goes away faster than the RNA skeleton, if you will. It seems that it's more stable on plastic than copper or steel. Stability depends on temperature and humidity. It likes moist, it likes cool. It doesn't like super hot and dry. Okay. Generally speaking, you see a rapid decay of the amount of virus on a surface within 48 to 72 hours. That is useful information, because if you're trying to develop policy for places of business and you find out, you know, on Sunday that somebody was in your workplace on Friday and they were infectious, you don't necessarily have to shut down your office for a whole week. You should have somebody go in there and clean the surfaces, but most of it's going to be gone. Most of it's going to be gone from most of the surfaces after about 72 hours. And there's some references there that you can go and look up. This I'll go over quickly. You all know these two images by now. If you don't, These are great teaching tools, and you can find them easily on the CDC's website. This was the case of the choir practice in the state of Washington, where you had one symptomatic person shown in red, and 87% of the group developed COVID-19. So that's all in the yellow. Clearly, the R naught for that individual was much, much greater than 4. Hence the sort of artificiality of even trying to assign an R naught to SARS-CoV-2, so dependent on the context. Wearing masks is protective. I hope you've heard the story about the hairstylists. When I heard it, it made me feel a lot better about going to get my hair cut. This was documented in Springfield, Missouri. You had two sick hairstylists who went to work and spent more than 15 minutes with each of their clients, which was 139 of them. Everybody was masked, nobody got sick. So once again, you can greatly modify the R naught of SARS-CoV-2 by what you do. Diagnosis, we're gonna skip. I think you've probably heard about that ad nauseum. Disease presentation, I'll let you scan these. I do want you to know that loss of sense and of taste and smell can be the only presenting symptom in some people. It's a very tiny minority that have only loss of taste or smell, but they are documented. Runny nose, only 7%. So those of us who suffer from allergies, just because you have your allergy from your runny nose doesn't mean you have to worry about it. Lots of disease complications. I think you've been hearing about them. Some of the scarier ones for me as a physician are seeing people come in with no risk factor for stroke, you know, young person who comes in and they've got an acute stroke because of the tendency to cause disease in blood vessels and blood clots that this virus has. About 15 to 30% of people who are hospitalized go to the ICU. Overall, about 15% of people who get hospitalized die of COVID. So going to the hospital is usually a bad thing. We don't hospitalize people unless they literally don't have enough oxygen in their blood. That's why people primarily come in, because they're hypoxemic. And you can get a tremendous amount of organ dysfunction through this mechanism of blood vessels being inflamed and having a tendency to cause blood clots. All right, you've heard a ton about hydroxychloroquine. I can spend time talking to you about this data if you like, but I'd like to save it for the end of the talk to see if that's where people want it, what the people want to discuss or not. I have spent a long time reviewing different papers, including retrospective studies, case series, case control studies, and more recently, emerging prospective studies, randomized, blinded, well-designed controlled trials that whether they are done for post-exposure prophylaxis or for mild disease or for serious disease or for critically ill patients, we are not seeing evidence of benefit in any prospective randomized trial, and there's potential for harm with hydroxychloroquine. Now, I'm not nuts about this. I took hydroxychloroquine all the time as a child growing up in Haiti for malaria prophylaxis. I'm not afraid of chloroquine. I'm here to tell you about my chloroquine exposure, but I am concerned that a drug that is prescription that has potential side effects continues to get peddled by people who feel desperate to offer something rather than nothing. And of course, it was one of the things that got politicized in this pandemic. We know that dexamethasone, the steroid, intravenously administered can reduce mortality for people who have an oxygen deficit. This was the recovery trial. Mortality was 29% versus 41% in those who are mechanically ventilated. MV stands for mechanical ventilation. Those sick people have an oxygen requirement. If you're on a ventilator, mortality was reduced in the recovery trial from 41% down to 29%. Remdesivir, which has been approved, is an intravenous only antiviral made by Gilead that reduces mortality very modestly, 6.7 from 12% by day 15. Also reduces hospital stay modestly. It has been scarce, and you can read about New England Journal of Medicine, the ACT-1 trial. Our hospital was one of the largest enrollers in the world for Act One, and we continue, this is an adaptive trial and it is ongoing. And we are currently in the phase that's looking at, everybody gets remdesivir, but now we're comparing the drug baricitinib to dexamethasone. So everyone gets remdesivir and we're comparing baricitinib versus dexamethasone. So the standard of care is clearly evolving. Most people are going to get a blood thinner because of all the blood clots that happened. And then a big disappointment that continues to be compounded by more data coming out is convalescent plasma. And, you know, we push for people to come and donate blood after recovering from COVID-19 disease. And now we have randomized trial data coming out from all over the world, an early study from China that was pretty disappointing. And published on November 20th in the New England Journal of Medicine was a paper on a study from Buenos Aires, Argentina, looking at severe pneumonia. And there was simply no significant difference in mortality among the people who got standard of care versus the people who got convalescent plasma, that 2.4, actually a difference, risk difference of 0.46%, and it was non-statistically significant. So very, very disappointing. And I think I've skipped over this last point. Just gave you the reference in the bottom there that the remdesivir trial results, which includes a lot of our data and our patients, was published in the November 5th New England Journal of Medicine. The image in this slide is showing a person lying on her stomach in the intensive care unit. This is called proning, and it's very interesting that when you have somebody simply flip over and lie on their stomach instead of on their back, you change the pattern of blood flow in the lungs and you can optimize oxygen exchange. And that can be helpful and help some people avoid getting intubated. But it's not a miracle cure. It's just one of the things we've learned to do. Now, part of the reason my slide deck got bigger is that we've had three new emergency use authorizations since the 9th of November. That's just less than 6 weeks. And the first one I want to tell you about are these monoclonal antibodies. The first one that got EUA approval was from Lilly, called bamlanivimab. I've had a lot of practice to pronounce it, but we had fun with that name when it first came out and people were singing songs about bamlanivimab and drawing cartoons about what they thought a bamlanivimab creature would look like if it were an animal. Just about the 21st of November, we had a second product on the market, and that was from Regeneron. And this is a combination of two different monoclonals, and they essentially work very similarly. They bind to the spike protein of the virus and prevent infection of human cells. But there are drawbacks. They can be given only intravenously. You cannot give them to somebody who is asymptomatic to prevent them from getting symptoms. And they were not shown to be helpful once somebody became hypoxic. Once you needed oxygen, these drugs did not help you. So we only give them if somebody is within 10 days of the onset of their symptoms and only if they are at high risk for disease progression. Because they're infectious, you have to have a special place to administer them. So you can't actually bring them to your hospital. You can't use your outpatient infusion center because that's where people are getting chemotherapy for their cancer and those people are immunocompromised. It's a problem. It also takes 3 hours because you got to set people up, screen them, put the IV in, the infusion takes an hour, and then you have to monitor them for 1 hour after because they can get a transfusion-like reaction or severe allergic reaction. There have to be emergency medical technician and folks who know how to do resuscitation on hand. It's rare that this happens, but there has been a case of anaphylaxis in the world from these monoclonal antibodies. Well, that's a big production, a lot of hullabaloo. Do they do anything? And the outcome that we care about is that if we give this properly to the right outpatients, we can reduce visitation to the emergency room or hospitalization rates from about 6.3% overall in the placebo people versus 1.6. So if your chance was 6.3% of going to the ER for your COVID and you got this drug within a timely way, your chances of going to the ER needing that kind of care would go down to 1.6%. If you look more closely, narrowly at people that are at high risk, so that would be people with a body mass index over 35, people who are older than age 64, or who have certain organ diseases, their risk in the placebo group was more like 14 or 15%. So, and the difference there was more significant than you see in the overall. There were similar rates of reducing emergency room and hospitalizations in the Regeneron monoclonal antibody combination. And the number needed to treat to actually help somebody was 16 people. All right, so these are good news, but it's good news with a lot of caveats. They're certainly not easy. Right now, you can get these in San Antonio. You have to have a doctor's referral. You go down to the Freeman Coliseum, which is a very special unit that was initially set up to be our overflow hospital area. There, it's staffed by EMTs, and we're able to do somewhere between 20 and 30 infusions daily, and that is ramping up. And we do anticipate that if the pandemic keeps on going, we may need to make accommodations for even more. The drugs are available in rather short supply, and it's a supply and demand thing. If you're actually using up your monoclonals, the federal government will allocate your site more. If you're letting them sit in a warehouse and not using them, you're not going to be on deck to get the next distribution. And this is an artist's rendition of what that looks like. So there's the virion in purple, that's the COVID virus, and the little Y-shaped things are meant to represent the monoclonal antibodies that are designed to specifically go and bind to the coronavirus's spike protein. Now, the third EUA, emergency use authorization, was for the drug baricitinib, which has a brand name of Olumiant from Eli Lilly, and it is an immunomodulator that's already been on the market, but not for this purpose. It turns out that this is now approved on an emergency basis only, and only in conjunction with remdesivir. So you've got to be sick enough to need remdesivir, which means you're needing oxygen, you need to be in the hospital. And this will tamp down the hyperinflammatory immune response that people are having. We only give it to people that are on lots of oxygen or extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, such as we call ECMO. What does it do? It cuts COVID time to recovery by about 12.5% from 8 to 7 days. I don't know about you, that's not all that exciting for me. That's compared to remdesivir alone. But it does improve the odds of clinical improvement at 15 days by about 30%. So incremental improvements. And this is the drug that's being compared head to head with dexamethasone together with remdesivir in our hospital right now. Who lives and who dies by age group? I have some people in my extended family who keep sending text messages saying that they think we should just let this pandemic rip, and it's just affecting old people really. So, you know, let's just deal with it. Here are the numbers. And if you look on the far left, you're seeing age groups from kids to over 85 year olds. And then on the far right, you're seeing deaths per 1,000 COVID-19 cases. So people who casually toss out that, oh, COVID, it only has a mortality rate of 0.9%. You need to ask them, what age group are you talking about? Because it's 304 per thousand, which is more like 30% if you're over 85. All right. So be very careful when people toss out mortality rates for all comers. And here's some slides that I'm just going to go over very quickly because I feel like you probably know them. But this is what the COVID-19 daily case count has looked like in recent days. If you see this spike here that we're seeing in December is really putting the spike that we thought was so big back in July to shame. I mean, look at that when you change the y-axis parameters, the spike that we saw in the summer pales in comparison to what we're seeing now. And then in San Antonio, my friend, Dr. Taylor, took the time to map out what was happening in San Antonio and just compared that to what the caseload looked like. The green shows case counts and blue is people who wind up in the hospital. We had our first stay at home order in March. And then we had a health transition team form to try to get people back to work. I was on that transition team. The governor had a strike force around the same time. We both released our plans. Our plans in San Antonio were different than the governor's. We started a 25% opening, then a 50% opening for everybody, and 25% with bars. So far, so good. And then we have had a bunch of protests. We had Memorial Day, and on June 3rd, bars went to 50%, and there was a ban on mask fines. And look at what happened to the case counts after that. And in spite of the rise, we continue to open up our economy to 75%. And then even though the counts were rising, we also went on and opened our amusement parks on the 19th of June. Finally, on the 22nd, we had a county mask order. On the 26th, we shut down the bars. And then on July 2nd, we had the state mask order. And you see how that correlates in time with subsequent declines in cases and hospitalizations. And so here's where we look right now in San Antonio in terms of our daily cases reported by date. We haven't surged back up to the peak that we saw in July, but at the rate we're going, we're going to have an area under the curve that's going to certainly meet and exceed that. These are the kinds of things we have to do in the hospital when you have a surge. We're thankful that we never exceeded 1,400 COVID cases in the hospital in the city of San Antonio, because had we exceeded it, we would have been sending people to the Freeman Coliseum, and that's where you don't want to be taken care of. Mortality rates will go up. You don't have the full support staff of a real hospital. So we create these surge teams, and I just want to point out to you that although it may sound wonderful that nobody had to go to the Freeman Coliseum, if you're on a COVID team, you may be taken care of by a hospitalist who's being supported not by an internal medicine resident, but by a dermatologist or a psychologist or psychiatrist rather. So this is not optimal care, obviously. Here's where we stand today in San Antonio. We're at 800 in the hospital. We continue to see this rise. The hospital curve is looking a little steeper than the actual daily case count. We're seeing a 12.5% positivity. We really want that down below 10% to feel more comfortable about people going to school. It seems to have peaked last week and starting to come down, but we don't make too much out of week by week changes. And University of Texas uses this surge demand calculator called SG2 that helps us figure out how many beds are going to be needed. So on the y-axis, on the vertical, you're looking at San Antonio regional hospitalizations. So that's COVID patients in hospital beds. And you see that peak of 1,400 in July. And you can see where we're at now on the dotted black line is actual numbers. And unfortunately, we seem to be following the trajectory of the orange. The orange is if we have people who continue to not adhere to social distancing and masking recommendations, whereas blue would be if people did better. So right now we are anticipating that we will continue to surge, maybe up to a little bit over 1,000, hopefully stay under 1,200, again, not exceed bed capacity. But we also see from this trajectory that we're anticipating this current surge to last longer than the big peak that we saw. Why is that? Well, we think the surge kind of started a little in mid-November, was accelerated by Thanksgiving, and we're heading into Christmas and New Year's, we're concerned that because people just have pandemic fatigue, they're not going to tamp back down as they did in the summertime. And, you know, you can either feel despondent about that, or you can look forward to the future and say, gosh, what could we do? What would be the effects of strict masking and what would be the effects of a rapid vaccine rollout? And, you know, look at April 21. And look at the difference of, you know, 40,000 deaths versus 30,000 deaths if we have universal masking and a rapid vaccine rollout versus just continuing to do what we're doing and easing the mandates. I'm sure those are compelling numbers, and I'm sure we in Texas care about saving tens of thousands of lives, and we can. This is me with my husband in the post-COVID vaccination observation area. We are not socially distanced because we are married, but everybody else in that room was 6 feet apart, I promise. And I've got a sticker on my jacket. If you look closely, it says, I got my COVID vaccine. And so really, this is what we need to focus on right now is vaccine readiness. We need to pull together as a community to save those lives. We need to just remind one another that masking is not political, not any more than fastening your seatbelt. I tell people we are literally in a war for our lives, and we're in a war for our way of life. My way of life is disrupted. I have not seen my mother since her husband, my stepfather, died a non-COVID death in August, but she couldn't be with him when he died. I haven't been able to be with her. This is a total disruption of things that we care about. So we have to fight the real enemy and not the virus. And I hope we're heading in that direction. This shot doesn't feel any different than the flu shot. I had it yesterday. You can see I'm smiling as the nurse is giving me my shot. It ain't no big thing, okay? It's just a little poke. And here are some of the data regarding the vaccines, but I wanna look at my time. And I see that about quarter till? Is that right, Linda? And would y'all like me to take you through some slides about vaccine and vaccine safety? Or would you like to pause right now and do some Q&A with me? Because I gave a lot of information really quickly. What are you interested in?
I think we should do some Q&A right now. And Dave Smith asked one question. I don't know if I'm going to, any info on Regeneron?
Yeah, Dr. Bergen answered that very well. I actually wrote the question right before the slide.
Okay.
I do have another question, though.
Okay, go ahead.
In San Antonio, if you look at the ethnicity of people that are getting COVID, it's really high, almost disproportionate in San Antonio with the number of people of Hispanic backgrounds compared to everybody else. Is it genetic? Is it culture? What really drives that?
No, well, so of course we have a majority minority city, right? So we have a largely Hispanic population, was it about 70%, but even so, a disproportionate number of the cases and the deaths are being borne by communities of color. It's disproportionate also in the African-American population. And it has to do with, what do you do and where do you do it? And are you able to stay home and isolate or not? And also has to track along with socioeconomic status. So we have a lot of multi-generational homes where the elderly people, the grandparents may actually be staying home, but they're in a communal living space in which the younger folks, the young adults are having to go out and work in grocery stores and restaurants, or heaven forbid, you know, meat packing plants. And those are places that put them at risk. People with higher levels of education and higher socioeconomic status are able to do their work from home, have full access to the internet, and so on and so forth. So it is not associated with a genetic predisposition, although I will say for balance in my comments that there are genome-wide associated studies or GWAS studies that are trying to identify clumps of genes that help predict who's going to get sick versus who not. But the best explanation that we have now for the disproportionate burden of this of disease in communities of color has to do with socioeconomic status and how much access people have to being able to follow the guidelines.
Dr. Berger, and I have a question, please. And this is regarding the socioeconomic and the communal living that you just described for the ethnicity groups discussed. One of the things that I keep hearing, and I don't know if it's truth or if it's just what you hear, because sometimes you don't hear truth on different programming, but there's fear amongst these communities in which to obviously get the shot, and that there's a tremendous percentage of these people who will not go and get a vaccine and will not help themselves. Are you hearing that in the city of San Antonio within your groups?
So actually, I helped Metro Health design a survey that went out to vaccine providers or potential vaccine providers, and we asked them about their own attitude towards the vaccine and how much hesitancy they had. And then we asked them what they think the hesitancy is or would be in their target patient population. And just back of the napkin, we're still analyzing this data. We got close to 400 responses from the community, and it wasn't from the community members themselves. That's a study that's being done by one of my colleagues, Dr. Robert Ferrer, and we hope to hear about that data soon. But the providers think that at least 60, and some think up to 80% of their population is going to be hesitant. And they believe that the hesitancy is coming from fears about the speed with which the vaccines have been developed, and that there has been a lot of variability in the quality of information that's been shared with people. There's been a lot of misinformation. There are COVID vaccine myths all over the place. There's a rumor circulating that I keep hearing about a chip, that if you get the vaccine, it's actually injecting you with, Bill Gates is injecting you with a chip to track you or harm you in some way. So as how do we do the, how do we deal with this? First of all, we need to understand people's fears. We need to look with a historical lens at the fact that many of these communities that are disadvantaged have had negative experiences with biomedical research in the past. And then we need to have very community-based health education, and that's something I'm quite passionate about. And I'm on the Education and Enforcement Working Group of the COVID-19 Community Response Coalition. It's a lot of words. City's got a CRC, a coalition. One of the components is education. I'm on that group, and we're really, really pushing the idea of getting peers, groups of peers and social influencers, and making sure they have a forum and a venue in which to receive accurate information. And then we give them suggested tools and ways of communicating accurate information to people who are near peers.
Okay. One more question in as a tag on is pregnancy. What is and what has been a study, if any, for someone who receives the vaccine if they plan on becoming pregnant in the next 10 months to a year? And okay. Do they get vaccinated or should they wait because we don't have that research?
Right.
Thank
you for the question. And I'm on a vaccine safety committee in the Health Science Center. So we've actually been talking about this very robustly in the last several days. So the Pfizer study, which is where we have the best look at the data. I haven't seen the Moderna data, but we will by the end of this week be looking at Moderna data. They excluded pregnant women, because that is frequently what happens with vaccine trials for concerns about needing for special protections of vulnerable populations. However, 23 people got pregnant in the Pfizer vaccine study by accident. They were told not to get pregnant. 23 of them got pregnant. 9 of them dropped out of the study, presumably after just having the first shot. The rest of them, 14, continue on the study. There was clearly no evidence of infertility being caused by the vaccine. And you would think that if the vaccine caused infertility, you wouldn't have seen these unexpected pregnancies. The small number of women that are in these trials have not shown any adversity so far. There are developmental and reproductive toxicity studies known as DART, D-A-R-T studies that are ongoing and FDA is monitoring. They are not ready to be released. However, preliminary reports are that the DART studies are not showing any evidence of toxicity to the fetus or to the pregnant woman. So the indication is not going to be for pregnant women, but there is now what's called permissive language from the CDC and their vaccine committee. The Committee on Immunization Practices, or ACIP, says that women should make this decision with their doctor, that pregnant women should have access to the vaccine. And if they are in a risk group with high risk for getting infected by virtue of what they do, and or at high risk for a bad outcome because of their baseline medical conditions, then they should be able to have the vaccine in consultation with their doctor.
Okay. Ruth, can you take us off? Can you stop sharing so we can see people when they have questions?
I don't know how, it says new share. How do I do stop sharing? Can somebody tell me? Stop sharing.
I have to.
Just found it.
Okay.
Found it.
Okay, good. Other questions?
Can I throw out a question, Linda? Dr. Ruth, I thought you did a great job and I thought you had great slides, and I'm going to ask Linda for copies of them later. But the question I'd like to put to you, if you were Tsarina Ruth of the United States, no Congress, no agencies, but you were in total command, tell us what you would order for the US, and would it be the same for Texas, and would it be the same for San Antonio?
So I would first like to remind everybody of the experience in New Zealand, where they don't have a Tsarina, but they have a prime minister whose name is Jacinda Ardern, who is an extremely gifted communicator and a relatable human being, who from the get-go was getting on Facebook and YouTube and talking to people like real human beings and being honest about what was known and what wasn't known and transparent about processes. New Zealand is on a couple of islands, right? So when they shut down their border, you know, it's different than say the United States. And they did a couple of novel things, two things that were, I think, really valuable. One is anybody coming into the country is put on notice that they will quarantine, and the government provides them with the quarantine site. The government transports the people from the airport to their quarantine hotel. I guess there's a lot of government subsidy for this 14-day mandatory quarantine on arriving in the country. And then they developed a special app with QR codes that everybody downloaded onto their phones, so that if you walk into Walmart, you just go and scan the QR code with your phone, and then that keeps a record of where you've been. Then they have a robust contact tracing, so that if there's been an exposure, they have an electronic database that allows them to go and notify people of potential exposures and whether they were for, you know, a significant amount of time. And that way people can quarantine more readily. So I think there are cultural differences between, you know, the United States and New Zealand that make that sort of intervention possible. When I think of New Zealand, I don't think about a totalitarian state that's anti-liberty. I think those people enjoy their freedom pretty much, but somehow they've been able to coalesce because they're not all divided and they haven't politicized this issue. And they've been able to proactively get on board with the measures that are being taken. So if I could be the Tsarina, I would want time travel. I'd want to go back in time and start this thing over from the get-go with less divisiveness and more of a spirit of unity. I do think that having you saw from our own community, the masking and bar closure, masking mandates and bar closures did something. There were other things happening too. All the other messages were being emphasized, but you can't kind of look at that data and then say, oh, well, we don't want to mandate masks and we don't want to bother the bars because it's just not really relevant.
I saw on that Johns Hopkins map, you don't have to go as far as New Zealand, it doesn't appear, because Canada was pretty void of the virus also. And they're right next door to us.
Yeah, I'm not as knowledgeable about the Canadian interventions. I studied the New Zealand ones in great detail because I was preparing for a leadership in global health class for my students. But thanks for pointing that out, Linda. I'll try to go study Canada and understand them better. What do you know about? What have you taken away from
the lesson? I don't know. I just looked at the red dots. So I wondered, how can they be so close to us and they have so little impact.
They have different geography, and to go to New Zealand has about 6 million people, which is about the population of DFW. They're very homogeneous. DFW is not at all homogeneous. So I don't think you can pick up the New Zealand procedure and apply it even to DFW, much less to the United States. I do agree, however, and I don't want to argue with the arena, because you have all the authority. So you can say, this is what we're going to do, but certainly close the borders at once, or open the borders a tiny bit and allow some quarantine. But I didn't hear you answer, are you suggesting that we do what New Zealand did? I didn't think you answered my question.
Well, I wanted us to look outside of ourselves for answers. And I accuse Texas and I accuse my own institution of examining their own navel a lot. I feel like we don't look outside of ourselves as often as we should to learn the lessons that have been learned elsewhere. So that's why I went in that direction. But I do think that clear, compassionate communication about why we need to do things and not waffling back and forth, also laying the groundwork for this is a new problem, it's a new phenomenon, and we're learning. So please, everybody, don't lose your faith in us if we tell you quarantine is 14 days, and then 3 months from now, we tell you quarantine is 10 days. We didn't lie to you the first time. We updated our guidelines based on new information that we got. So helping people understand this, communicating it in a compassionate way, and then having certain things that really should be mandated. I think we should have stronger mask mandates, and I think that people should suffer the consequences and get fined if they're not willing to wear masks.
And we should get rid of all social media.
Well, social media
good luck
is a challenge. I mean, that is a tool that we can
use. The bane of our existence, doctor. You know, I mean,
about how to use.
Well, can I ask you a quick question, doctor, before everybody leaves? And first of all, I do want to thank you for everything you've done and your devotion and dedication. You mentioned masks, and everybody wears all kinds of different masks. And I'm not sure, you know, I got the reusable ones. I think they're fine. I wash them. Not everybody can get in N95. So could you make a little comment on your opinion on masks and what type of mask? And
So you want to wear a mask. If it's a cloth mask, it needs to have 2 or 3 layers. The denser the weave, the better. It has to have a good fit. You got to work with different models to find one that doesn't fog up your glasses like I have. You need to make sure there's not a big gap here on the side. Be aware that masks that have valves, one-way valves, are not helpful. They're protecting you, but you're blowing your air out through that valve and you're infecting everybody else. Instead of what happens when you blow out through the mask without a valve, your air is filtered through that mask and some of it is directed downwards, so it's not going outwards to people. So surgical masks, the kind of procedure masks that you see in the medical world, we were discouraging people about those early on because we needed to save them for health personnel. Now the shortages are not so dire. Those things are readily available in every HEB. So those are fine. And if you're doing cloth, it needs to meet the criteria that I just stated and don't get a valve. There's another phenomenon now, which is people have these clear plastic masks and they're kind of rigid. And it's sort of a hybrid between a face shield and a mask. And they're kind of excited about them because they feel like, well, now people can see my face and they can see I'm not a jerk. But those are not accomplishing it. They're accomplishing about the same thing that a face shield would, which is it's kind of like an umbrella. it's going to catch some of the big droplets that are coming at you. But it's not preventing you from, it's not filtering anything because all your air is going to go out the sides.
What's a good recommendation on washing the reusable mask?
So I think that you should wash them at least every couple of days, and you should wash them if they're dirty. What's happening at my house is we have so many of them that they're probably getting worn by individuals once or twice, and then they lie around. But periodically, we scoop them all up and put them in the laundry and just wash them like you would your regular laundry.
Well, I appreciate it because I know there's so much out there and all the fancy stuff and this and that, you know, and it's, you know, but realistically, what's the right hygiene for a mask and the right type of mask? So that I appreciate because I'm like everybody else. I got 4, 5, or 6 and just kind of rotate them.
Right. Well, you should probably, if you got 6 of them, you should scoop them all up and wash them in the hot water at least once a week.
I do. I'm doing that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Melissa, sure.
Sorry. Hey, Brian, I know at our school, they are telling the kids a fresh mask every single day and they have to be washed. So but that's not my question. Dr. Bergeron, I thought you did an amazing job. You have such a gift for teaching and for education because the way you went through things was very clear, easy to understand. I wanted to ask you a question about flu versus COVID, because I'm hearing that the flu numbers are down. I don't know if that's true or not. So why are the flu numbers down, but COVID numbers are up? How can you have it both ways?
So they're transmitted in similar fashion, but we do have a flu vaccine and we don't have a COVID vaccine. So I don't have a crystal ball, but I will say that we made a big deal out of flu vaccine this year. And I don't even have the numbers to report back to you, but I would hope that because you had more uptake, that you would see less flu.
Well, they're doing pretty good in the schools. That's where it's usually caught. Mm-hmm. And they're social distancing. They're being very careful because of COVID, which would make the flu not so prevalent.
The other thing, we're still learning about the airborne transmission versus droplet. And yeah. I showed you that their difference is in size. I have no idea if that has anything to bear, but we're going to be learning more about it. And it's an interesting question.
Well, I was just curious. I have a friend who I don't think is necessarily a COVID believer, but I am. And I don't know if she is a mask believer either, but I am. So, you know, when I hear those questions, because I'm not a doctor, I just, I'm curious.
So is her premise that this must all be fake because how could COVID be up when flu is down? I think
that's her point of view. Yes.
Well, what I would say to her is please come on rounds with me and mm-hmm. please see what it's like to talk to a 33-year-old woman who you're trying to enroll in a clinical trial who breaks down weeping and says, sorry, I can't talk right now because she just found out that her boyfriend who's in the ICU is about to get taken off of the ventilator. And she just had to arrange with the family and the physicians, like when she might be able to actually go up to the ICU to bid that person goodbye. I would like to tell your friend the story of the spouse of a hospitalist that I work with, who was in his 40s with no comorbidities, came in on time with a physician advocate spouse, got all the drugs, was getting better, and then took a turn for the worse with this inflammatory syndrome. And the day that I rounded on him, Thanksgiving Day, we had to transfer him to SAMC for ECMO. And then when I texted with my friend a week later, she said he died. So I'm sorry that there are disbelievers, but I am there in the trenches. People are dying and it is tragic. And we can bring back our economy. We cannot bring back the dead. I'm sorry, I'm very passionate about that. But I would invite people who have this issue to humble themselves and take a listen to their neighbors, because we're up to 303,000 deaths in this country. Surely you know somebody who knows somebody who's had a death, and maybe you ought to listen to their story.
Mm-hmm. And with that, I think we should end this. And I applaud your conviction on that. I really do. This was great. Didn't you all enjoy it? And we are going to be sending out the information of everybody who came here. So if it's okay with you, if somebody has a personal question, they might be able to email you and ask you that question. And at your leisure, which I know you have very little of, perhaps you can answer them or direct them to where they need to go. Would that be okay?
Sure.
All right. For now, I say happy holidays to everybody. Enjoy this month off. And it's been a great year. We had 30 meetings this year, and yours was our 30th. And so we're going to enjoy the holidays and try to stay as optimistic as possible. Hopefully we will, you know, in 2021, things will get back to a relatively, it'll be a new normal. I don't think we're ever going to see the old normal, but it will be workable. I hope that'll happen. So.
Well, thank you, Linda, and everybody. I wish everybody a happy and a safe holiday season.
Thank you.
Okay.
Vaccine is coming. Hope is on the way.
Yay. I know. Yay. Okay. Yay. Thanks so much, Ruth.
Thank you.